infantry, the words took on new significance. "Come on, Cass." Ruby was standing at the other end of the path by the cottage door, stamping her little feet. "I went along with the hike with barely a complaint. Surely you don't expect me to scale the walls and find a window to climb through?" Cassandra smiled and held up the brass key. "Never fear. No more physical challenges. Not for today, anyway. We'll save the hidden garden for tomorrow." She inserted the key in the lock and turned it to the left with a clunk, then pushed open the door. Ruby stepped across the threshold and made her way along the hall towards the kitchen doorway. It was much lighter inside now that Cassandra and Christian had cleared the window panes of creepers and washed a century of grime from the glass. "Oh, my," Ruby whispered, eyes wide as she took in the kitchen. "It's unspoiled."
"That's one way of putting it."
"No one's destroyed it under the guise of modernization. What an incredibly rare find." She turned to Cassandra. "It has a wonderful feel about it, doesn't it? Enveloping. Warm, somehow. I can almost feel the ghosts of the past moving about among us." Cassandra smiled. She had known Ruby would feel it too. "I'm so glad you could come, Ruby."
"I wouldn't have missed it," she said, crossing the room. "Gray's just about taken to wearing earplugs when we meet. He's so bloody sick of my talking about your Cornish cottage. Plus, I had business in Polperro, so the whole thing couldn't have worked out better."
Ruby leaned against the rocking chair to peer through the front window.
"Is that a pond out there?"
"Yeah, just a little one."
"Cute statue. Wonder if he's cold."
She let go of the rocking chair so that it was set in gentle motion. The treads squeaked softly against the floorboards. Ruby continued her inspection of the room, running her fingers lightly along the rim of the range shelf.
"What was your business in Polperro?"
Cassandra sat cross-legged on the kitchen table.
"My exhibition ended last week, and I was returning the Nathaniel Walker sketches to their owner. Just about broke my heart to part with them, I can tell you."
"No way she'd consider giving them to the museum on permanent loan?"
"Well, that'd be nice."
Ruby's head had disappeared into the bricked range alcove, and her voice was muffled.
"Perhaps you can sweet-talk her for me."
"Me? I've never met her."
"Well, not yet, of course you haven't. But I mentioned you to her when I was there. Told her all about your grandma being related to the Mountrachets, having been born here at Blackhurst, how she came back and bought the cottage. Clara was most interested."
"Really? Why would she care?" Ruby stood up, bumping her head on the range shelf.
"Bugger!" She rubbed the spot furiously. "Always the bloody head."
"Are you all right?"
"Yes, yes, I'm fine. High pain threshold."
She stopped rubbing, blinked her eyes clear.
"Clara's mum used to work at Blackhurst, remember? As a domestic. Mary, the one who ended up making black puddings with her butcher husband."
"Yeah, I remember now. So how did you know Clara was interested in Nell? What did she say?" Ruby resumed her inspection of the range, opening the great door.
"She said there was something she wanted to talk to you about, something her mum had told her before she died."
The skin on Cassandra's neck prickled.
"What was it? Did she say anything else?" "Not to me. And don't go getting too excited. Knowing the reverence in which she held her old mum, it may well be she thinks you'll be pleased to learn that Mary spent the best years of her life in service at the grand old house. Or that Rose once paid her a compliment on her silver polishing."
Ruby closed the great door, turned towards Cassandra.
"I don't suppose the range still works."
"It does, actually. We couldn't believe it."
"We?"
"Christian and I."
"Who's Christian?"
Cassandra ran her fingertips along the table's rim. Oh, a friend. Someone who's been helping with the clean-up. Ruby's brows arched.
A friend?
Huh? Yeah. Cassandra shrugged, tried to seem nonchalant. Ruby smiled knowingly.
Nice to have friends.
She made her way to the back of the kitchen, past the window with the broken pane, to the antique spinning wheel. I don't suppose I'll get to meet him. She reached out and turned the wheel. Careful, said Cassandra. Don't prick your finger.
No, indeed.
Ruby let her fingers skim the top of the turning wheel. I don't want to be responsible for putting us both to sleep for 100 years. She bit her bottom lip. Eyes twinkled.
Though it would give your friend an opportunity to rescue us.
Cassandra felt her cheeks flush. She pretended casualness while Ruby took in the exposed beams of the ceiling, the blue and white tiles around the stove, the wide floorboards.
So, she said finally, what do you think?
Ruby rolled her eyes.
You know what I think, Cass. I'm jealous as hell. It's fabulous.
She came to lean against the table. Still planning to sell it?
Yeah, I guess so.
You're stronger than I am. Ruby shook her head. I wouldn't be able to part with it.
From nowhere, a flash of possessive pride. Cassandra quelled it.
I have to. I can't just leave it sitting here. The maintenance would be too much, especially with me all the way on the other side of the world.
You could keep it as a holiday house, rent it out when you're not using it. Then we'll always have somewhere to stay when we need some seaside.
She laughed.
That is, you'll have somewhere to stay.
She nudged Cassandra with her shoulder.
Come on, show me what's upstairs. I bet there's a killer view.
Cassandra led the way up the narrow stairs, and when they reached the bedroom, Ruby leaned against the windowsill.
Oh, Cass, she said, as the wind plucked white tips on the surface of the sea. You'd have people lined up to holiday here. It's unspoiled, close enough to the village for supplies, far enough away to feel private. It must be glorious at sunset, and then at night, when the distant lights of the fishing boats sparkle like little stars.
Ruby's comments both excited and frightened Cassandra, for she had given voice to Cassandra's secret wish, a sentiment she hadn't even realized she felt until she'd heard it expressed by someone else. She did want to keep the cottage, no matter that she knew the sensible thing was to sell it. The atmosphere of the place had made its way beneath her skin. There was its connection to Nell, but there was something more. A sense that all was well when she was in the cottage and its garden. Well with the world, and well within herself. She felt whole and solid for the first time in 10 years. Like a circle complete. A thought without dark edges.
Oh, my God! Ruby turned and clutched Cassandra's wrist.
What?
Cassandra's stomach lurched. What is it?
I've just had the most brilliant idea. She swallowed, motioned with her hand as she caught her breath.
A sleepover! She squealed finally. You and me, tonight. Here in the cottage!
Cassandra had already been to the market and was leaving the hardware shop with a cardboard box full of candles and matches when she bumped into Christian. It had been 3 days since they'd had supper at the pub. There'd been far too much rain to even contemplate returning to the hidden garden over the weekend, and she hadn't seen or spoken to him since. She felt oddly nervous, could feel her cheeks flushing.
Going camping?
Sort of. A friend has come to visit and wants to spend a night in the cottage.
He raised his eyebrows. Don't let the ghosts bite.
I'll try.
Or the rats.
He gave a lopsided smile. She smiled too, then pressed her lips together. The silence drew out like a rubber band, threatened to snap back. She started shyly, "Hey, you know, you could come up and have a bite of dinner with us. Nothing fancy, but it'll be fun, if you're free, I mean. I know Ruby would love to meet you." Cassandra flushed and cursed the thread of query that had lifted the end of her sentences. "It'll be fun," she said again. He nodded, seemed to be considering. "Yeah," he said. "Sure. Sounds good." "Great." Cassandra felt a ripple beneath her skin. 7 o'clock? And no need to bring anything. As you can see, I'm well stocked." "Oh, hey, give me that." Kristen took Cassandra's cardboard box. She shifted the handles of her plastic grocery bag from around her wrist and scratched the red imprints they'd made. "I'll give you a lift up the cliff walk," he said. "I don't want to put you out." "You're not. I was on my way to see you anyway, about Rose and her marks."
"Oh, I couldn't find anything else in the scrap."
"It doesn't matter. I know what they were, and I know how she got them." He gestured towards his car. "Come on, we can talk while I drive." Christian maneuvered his car out of the tight parking spot by the water's edge and drove along the main street.
"So what is it?" said Cassandra. "What did you find?"
The windows had fogged up, and Christian reached out to wipe the windscreen with his palm. "When you were telling me about Rose the other day, there was something familiar. It was the doctor's name, Ebenezer Matthews. I couldn't for the life of me remember where I'd heard it. Then early Saturday morning it came to me. At university, I took a course on medical ethics, and as part of the assessment, we had to write a paper on historical uses of new technologies." He slowed the car at a T-intersection and fiddled with the heating. "Sorry, it plays up sometimes. Should be warm in a minute." He pushed the dial from blue to red, indicated left, and started up the steep cliff road. "One of the benefits of living back home is that I've got ready access to the boxes my life was packed into when my stepmom turned my room into a gym." Cassandra smiled, remembering the boxes of embarrassing high school memorabilia she'd uncovered when she moved back in with Nell after the accident. "Took me a while, but finally I found the essay, and sure enough, there was his name, Ebenezer Matthews. I'd included him because he was from the same village I'd grown up in."
"And was there something in the essay about Rose?"
"Nothing like that, but after I realized who Rose's Dr. Matthews was, I emailed a friend up at Oxford who works in the medical library. She owed me a favor and agreed to send me anything she could on the doc's patients between 1889 and 1913, Rose's lifetime." A friend. She. Cassandra pushed aside the unexpected surge of envy. "And?" "Doc Matthews was quite a busy boy. Not at first. For someone who rose to such lofty heights, he came from humble beginnings. Doctor in a small town in Cornwall, doing all the things young doctors in small towns do. His big break, from what I can gather, was meeting Adeline Mountrachet of Blackhurst Manor. I don't know why she would have chosen a young doctor like him when her little girl was sick. Aristocrats were much more likely to call upon the same old ghost who'd treated great-uncle Curno when he was a boy. But whatever the case, Ebenezer Matthews was summoned. He and Adeline must have hit it off, too, because after that first consultation, he became Rose's regular doctor. Stayed that way all throughout her childhood. even after she was married. But how do you know? How did your friend find that sort of information? A lot of doctors back then kept surgery logs, records of the patients they saw, who owed the money, treatments they prescribed, articles they published, that sort of thing. Many of the logs wound up in libraries. They were donated or sold, usually by the doctor's family. They'd reached the end of the road where gravel gave way to grass, and Christian pulled the car over onto the narrow parking strip by the lookout. Outside, the wind was buffeting the cliff, and the tiny cliff birds huddled together glumly. He switched off the ignition, turned in his seat to face Cassandra. In the last decade of the 19th century, Dr. Matthews began to make a bit of a name for himself. It seems he wasn't content with his lot as a country GP, even though his patient list was beginning to resemble a who's who of local society. He started publishing on various medical matters. It wasn't very difficult to cross-reference his publications with his log to find out that Rose appears as Miss R.M. She becomes a frequent entry after 1897. Why? What happened then? Cassandra realized she was holding her breath. Her throat was tight. When Rose was 8, she swallowed a sewing thimble. Why? Well, I don't know. Accident, I expect. And it's beside the point. It wasn't a big deal. Half the British currency has sat inside a child's stomach at one point or another. They pass through without too much difficulty if they're left alone. Cassandra exhaled suddenly. But it wasn't left alone. Dr. Matthews performed an operation. Christian shook his head. Worse than that. Her stomach lurched. What did he do? He ordered an X-ray, a couple of X-rays, and then he published the pictures in The Lancet. Christian reached to the back seat and pulled out a photocopied piece of paper, handed it to her. She glanced at the article, shrugged. I don't get it. What's the big deal? It's not the X-ray itself. It's the exposure. He pointed to a line at the top of the page. Dr. Matthews had the photographer take a 60-minute exposure. I guess he wanted to be sure he got his picture. Cassandra could feel the cold outside her glass window shimmering against her cheek. But what does it mean, a 60-minute exposure? X-rays are radiation. Haven't you ever noticed the way your dentist sprints from the room before pushing the X-ray button? An exposure of 60 minutes means that between them, Dr. Matthews and the photographer fried her ovaries and everything inside them. Her ovaries? Cassandra stared at him. Then how did she conceive? That's what I'm saying. She didn't. She couldn't. That is, she certainly couldn't have carried a healthy baby to term. As of 1897, Rose Mountrachet was, to all intents and purposes, infertile. Chapter 41. Cliff Cottage, 1975. Despite a 10-day delay before contracts were due to be exchanged, young Julia Bennett had been most obliging. When Nell requested early access to the cottage, she'd handed over the key with a wave of her jewelry-laden wrist. "Doesn't worry me a bit," she'd said, bangles clacking. "You make yourself at home. Lord knows, the key's so heavy, I'll be happy to have it off my hands." The key was heavy. It was big and brass, with intricate swirls at one end, blunt teeth at the other. Nell looked at it, almost the length of her palm. She laid it on the wooden table in the kitchen. The kitchen of her cottage. Well, almost her cottage. 10 days to go. Nell wouldn't be in Tregenna when she exchanged. Her flight left London in 4 days' time, and when she'd tried to change the booking, she'd been told that such late alterations were possible only at exorbitant cost. So she'd decided to go home to Australia as planned. The local solicitors handling her purchase of Cliff Cottage were happy to hold the key for her until she returned. It wouldn't be long, she'd assured them. She just needed time to sort out her things, and then she'd be back for good. For Nell had decided she was going home to Brisbane for the last time. What had she there to keep her? A few friends? A daughter who didn't need her? Sisters, she perplexed. Her antiques shop she would miss, but perhaps she could start afresh here in Cornwall. And when she was here, with more time, Nell would get to the bottom of her mystery. She would learn why Eliza stole her and put her on the boat to Australia. All lives needed purpose, and this would be Nell's. For otherwise, how would she ever know herself? Nell walked slowly about the kitchen, making a mental inventory. The first thing she intended to do when she got back was to give the cottage a thorough clean. Dirt and dust had long been allowed free rein, and every surface was coated. There would be repairs to make, too. The skirting boards would need replacing in sections. There was bound to be wood rot. The kitchen would have to be brought to working order. Of course, a village like Tregenna would have any number of local tradesmen available to help, but Nell balked at the idea of employing strangers to work in her cottage. Although made of stone and wood, it was more than a house to Nell. And just as she had tended Lil when she was dying, had refused to pass responsibility into the hands of a kindly stranger, Nell knew she must tend the cottage herself. Use the skills that Hugh had taught her all those years before, when she was a little girl, wide-eyed with love for her dad. Nell stopped by the rocking chair. A little shrine in the corner caught her attention. She went closer. A half-empty drink bottle, a packet of digestive biscuits, a comic called Whizzer and Chips. They had certainly not been there when Nell made her purchasing inspection, which could only mean that someone had been in her cottage since. Nell flicked through the comic book. A young someone, by the looks. A moist breeze brushed Nell's face, and she looked to the back of the kitchen. The window was missing a pane of glass from one of its 4 square frames. Making a mental note to bring plastic and tape to mask it before she left Tregenna, Nell peered through. A huge hedge ran parallel to the house, blunt and even, almost like a wall. A flash of colour, and Nell thought she saw movement at the corner of her vision. When she looked again, there was nothing. A bird, probably. Or a squirrel. Nell had noticed on the map sent to her by the solicitor that the property extended quite a way beyond the house. That meant, presumably, that whatever lay on the other side of the tall, thick hedge was hers too. She decided to take a look. The path that wound around the side of the house was narrow and dim from lack of sun. Nell went cautiously, pushing long weeds aside as she went. At the back of the cottage, brambles had grown between the house and the hedge, and Nell had to pick her way through the tangle. Midway along, she sensed movement again, right by her. Nell looked at the ground. A pair of shoe-clad feet and skinny legs protruded from beneath the wall. Either the wall had fallen from the sky, a la Wizard of Oz, and crushed some poor, unfortunate Cornish dwarf, or she had found the small person who'd been trespassing in her cottage. Nell grabbed hold of the skinny ankle. The legs froze. "Come on, then," she said. "Out with you." Another moment of stillness,
Then the legs began scrambling backwards. The boy they were attached to looked to be about 10, though Nell had never been particularly good at guessing the ages of children. He was a scrap of a lad, with sandy brown hair and knobbly knees, bruises up and down his bony shins. "I presume you're the young monkey who's been making free with my cottage." The boy blinked dark brown eyes at Nell before looking to the ground at her feet. "What's your name, then? Out with it."
"Christian."
So soft she almost hadn't heard.
"Christian who?"
"Christian Blake. Only I wasn't doing any harm. My dad works over at the big estate, and sometimes I just like to come and visit the walled... your walled garden."
Nell glanced at the bramble-covered wall. "So that's a garden behind there, is it?"
I had wondered.
She looked back at the boy. "And tell me, Christian, does your mother know where you are?"
The boy's shoulders slumped. "I haven't got a mother."
Nell's eyebrows raised.
"She went away to hospital in the summer, and then..."
The heat of Nell's ill temper cooled on a sigh.
"I see. Well, and what are you? 9? 10? Nearly 11?
Healthy indignation sent his hands into his pockets, his elbows out to the side.
"Of course, I see that now. I have a granddaughter about your age."
"Does she like gardens too?"
Nell blinked at him.
"I'm not sure."
Christian tilted his head to the side, frowned at her answer.
"That is, I imagine she does."
Nell found herself skirting apology. Chastised herself. She needn't feel contrite just because she didn't know Leslie's daughter's mind.
"I don't see her often."
"Does she live a long way from you?"
"Not really, no."
"Then why don't you see her much?"
Nell eyed the boy, trying to decide whether his impertinence was charming or not. "Sometimes that's just the way things are." By the look on the boy's face, this explanation sounded as weak to him as it did to her. But there were some things that didn't need explanation, especially to strange little boys trespassing on one's property. Nell reminded herself that the little scamp was newly motherless. There were none immune to poor judgment when their certainties had been pulled from under them. Nell knew that as well as anyone. Life could be so bloody cruel. Why should this boy grow up motherless? Why should some poor woman go to an early grave, leaving her lad to make his way in the world without her? Looking at the boy's skinny limbs, Nell felt something inside her tighten. Her voice was gruff, but kind. "What is it you said you were doing in my garden anyway?"
"I wasn't doing any harm, honest. I just like to sit inside."
"And this is how you get in?
Under the bricks?"
He nodded. Nell eyed the hole.
"I don't think I'll fit beneath there. Where's the gate?"
"There isn't one. At least, not on this wall."
Nell frowned. "I have a garden with no entrance."
He nodded again. "There used to be one. You can see from inside where it was patched up."
"Why would anyone patch up the entrance?"
The boy shrugged, and Nell made an addition to her mental list of necessary improvements.
"Perhaps you can tell me what I'm missing then," she said, "seeing as I'm not going to be able to take a look myself. What it is that brings you all the way up here?"
"It's my favorite place in the whole world."
Christian blinked his earnest brown eyes.
"I like to sit inside and talk to my mum. She loved gardens, She loved your walled garden specially. She's the one who showed me how to get inside. We were going to try and fix it up. Then she got sick. Nell pressed her lips together. I'm going home to Australia in a couple of days, but I'll be back in a month or two. I wonder whether you might not keep an eye on my garden for me, Christian. He nodded gravely. I can do that. I'll be glad to know I've left it in capable hands. Christian stood tall. And when you come back, I'll help you fix it all up. Like my dad does over at the hotel. Nell smiled. I might well hold you to that. I don't accept help from just anyone, but I have a feeling that in this case, you're the right man for the job. Chapter 42, Blackhurst Manor, 1913. Rose gathered the shawl around her shoulders and crossed her arms against a chill that wouldn't be warmed away. When she'd decided to seek sun in the garden, Eliza had been the last person she'd expected to see. As Rose had sat making notes in her scrapbook, looking up occasionally to see ivory fluttering and swooping around the flowerbeds, there'd been no indication that the day's peace was to be so horridly shattered. Some peculiar sense had made her glance towards the maze gates, and there had been the sight that chilled Rose's blood. How had Eliza known that she would find Rose and Ivory alone in the garden? Had she been watching, waiting for just such a time when she might catch Rose off guard? And why now? Why, after 3 years, had she materialized today? Like a nightmare specter crossing the lawn, wretched parcel in her hand. Rose glanced sideways. There it sat, masquerading as a harmless thing. But it wasn't. Rose knew that. She didn't need to look beneath the brown paper wrapping to know what lurked within. An object representing a place, a time, a union Rose wanted so much to forget. She gathered her skirts and smoothed them against her thigh, trying to create some distance between herself and it. A flock of starlings took flight, and Rose looked towards the kidney lawn. Mama was coming towards her, the new hound, Helmsley, stalking close to her dark skirts. A wash of relief left Rose light-headed. Mama was an anchor back to the present, to a safe world where everything was as it should be. As Adeline drew near, Rose could contain her anxiety no longer. "Oh, Mama," she said quickly. "She was here. Eliza was here." "I saw it all from the window. What did she say? Did the child hear anything she should not?" Rose ran the encounter back through her mind, but worry had conspired with fear to wrinkle the edges of her memory, and she could no longer tease loose the precise words that had been spoken. She shook her head miserably. "I don't know." Adeline glanced at the parcel, then lifted it from the bench, cautiously, as if it were hot to the touch. "Don't open it, Mama, please. I cannot bear to see inside." Rose's voice was almost a whisper. "Is it?" "I'm quite sure it is." Rose pressed cold fingers against her cheek. "She said it was for Ivory." Rose looked at her mother, and a fresh wave of panic surged beneath her skin. "Why would she bring it, Mama? Why?" Mama's lips tightened. "What did she mean by it?" "I believe the time has come that you must put some distance between yourself and your cousin." Adeline sat beside Rose and laid the parcel across her lap. "Distance, Mama." Rose's cheeks cooled, her voice dropped to a terrified whisper. "You don't think she might?"
might come again. She has proven today that she holds no respect for the rules that were laid out. But, Mama, surely you don't think... I think only that I wish for your continued well-being. As Rosa's daughter fluttered beneath the dappled light, Adeline leaned close, so close that Rose felt a smooth upper lip against her ear. "We must remember, my darling," she whispered, "that a secret is never safe when it is known by others." Rose nodded slightly. Mama was right, of course. It had been folly to think all might continue indefinitely. Adeline stood and rolled her wrist, motioning Helmsley to heel. "Thomas is about to serve luncheon. Don't be long. You needn't compound the day's unpleasantness by catching a chill." She returned the parcel to the seat and lowered her voice. "And have Nathaniel dispose of that." Racing footsteps every which way overhead, and Adeline winced. It mattered not how many times she delivered the well-worn diatribe on young ladies and fitting behavior. The child would not be taught. It was to be expected, of course. No matter the pretty wrapping in which Rose clad her, the girl was common born. There was no escaping that. Cheeks that glowed too pink, laughter that echoed along the halls, curls that escaped her ribbons. She was as unlike Rose as was possible. And yet Rose adored the girl. Thus had Adeline accepted her, schooled herself to smile at the child, meet her impertinent gaze, tolerate her noise. What wouldn't Adeline do for Rose? What hadn't she already done? But Adeline understood, too, that it was her duty to maintain a stern and ready hand, for the child would need firm guidance if she were to escape the pitfalls of her birth. The circle of those who knew the truth was small, and so must it remain. To allow otherwise was to invite the hideous spectre of scandal. It was imperative, therefore, that Mary and Eliza be properly managed. Adeline had worried at first that Rose might not understand, that the innocent girl might imagine all could continue as before. But on that count she had been pleasantly surprised. The moment Ivory was placed in Rose's arms, a change had come over her. She was seized by a fierce maternal desire to protect her child. Rose had agreed with Adeline that certainly Mary and Eliza must stay away, sufficient distance to preclude a daily presence, yet close enough to remain within the sphere of Adeline's influence. Only in that way could it be ensured that neither divulged what they knew about the child at Blackhurst Manor. Adeline had assisted Mary in the purchase of a little house in Polperro, and Eliza had been permitted tenure at the cottage. Although a part of Adeline lamented the permanent proximity to Eliza, it was the lesser of two evils, and Rose's happiness was paramount. Dear Rose, she'd looked so pale, sitting alone on the garden seat, had barely touched her luncheon afterwards, merely moved it about the plate, this way and that. She was resting now, warding off the return of a migraine that had haunted her all week. Adeline opened the fist which had clenched itself in her lap and flexed her fingers thoughtfully. She had made conditions perfectly clear when all was arranged. Neither girl was to set foot again on the Blackhurst estate. The stipulation was simple, and to this date each had complied. The wings of security had closed over the secret, and life at Blackhurst had adopted a peaceful rhythm. What then was Eliza thinking, breaking her word now? In the end, Nathaniel waited until Rose was in bed resting her nerves, and Adeline was out visiting. That way, he reasoned, neither need ever learn the method by which he ensured Eliza's continued absence. Ever since he'd heard what had happened, Nathaniel had been mulling over how best to set things right. To see his wife in such a state was a chilling reminder that, despite the distance they had travelled, the blessed reversal after Ivory was born,
The other Rose, worry-worn, tense, erratic, was never far beneath the surface. He had known instantly that he must speak with Eliza, find a way to make her understand that she could never come again. Some time had passed since his last venture through, and he'd forgotten how dark it was within the bramble walls, how briefly the sun's rays were permitted entry. He went carefully, trying to remember which turns to make. A far cry from the time, 4 years ago, when he had torn hotly through the maze in pursuit of his sketches. He'd arrived at the cottage, blood pulsing, shoulders heaving from the unusual exertion, and had demanded the sketches' return. They were his, he'd said. They were important to him. He needed them. And then, when he'd run out of things to say, he'd stood, catching his breath, waiting for Eliza to respond. He wasn't sure what he'd expected. A confession. An apology. A handover of the sketches. All of these things, perhaps. But she had given none. Rather, she'd surprised him. After a moment spent regarding him in the way one might a minor curiosity, she'd blinked those pale, changeable eyes that he itched to draw, and asked whether he would care to contribute illustrations for a book of fairy tales. A noise, and the memory fled. Nathaniel's heart stepped up its beat. He turned and glanced through the dim space behind him. A lone robin blinked at him before flying away. Why was he so jumpy? He had the frayed nerves of a guilty man, a ridiculous state as there was nothing inappropriate in his actions. He intended only to speak with Eliza, request that she resist breaching the maze gates. And his mission, after all, was for Rose's sake. It was his wife's health and well-being that were uppermost in his mind. He went faster, reassuring himself that he was manufacturing danger where there was none. His mission might be secret, but it was not illicit. There was a difference. He had agreed to illustrate the book. How could he resist, and why should he have? To sketch was his dearest wish, and to illustrate her fairy tales allowed him to slip inside a world that didn't recognize the particular regrets in his own life. It had been a lifeline, a secret pursuit that made the long days of portraiture tolerable. At meetings with wealthy, titled dullards, when Adeline pressed him forward yet again and he was required to smile and perform convivially like a trained hound, he had nursed to himself the secret knowledge that he was also bringing to life the magical world of Eliza's tales. He'd never had a finished copy of his own. Publication had been delayed for one reason or another, and by the time the book was finally printed, it was clear to him how unwelcome such would be at Blackhurst. Once, in the early days of the project, he'd committed the grave error of mentioning the book to Rose. He had thought she might be glad, might appreciate the union of her husband and her dearest cousin, but he had been mistaken. Her expression was one he would never forget. Shock and anger, mixed together with bereavement. He had betrayed her, she said. He didn't love her. He wanted to leave her. Nathaniel had been at a loss as to how to understand. He had done what he always did on such occasions, reassured Rose and asked whether he might sketch her portrait for his collection. And he kept the project to himself from that day forward. But he didn't give it up. He couldn't. After Ivory was born and Rose was restored, the trailing threads of his life had plaited slowly back together. Strange the power of a tiny baby to bring life to a dead place. To lift the black pall that had covered everything. Rose, their marriage, Nathaniel's own soul. It hadn't been instant, of course. To begin with, where the child was concerned, Nathaniel had trodden cautiously, taken his lead from Rose, mindful always of the possibility that the baby's origins might prove insurmountable. Only when he saw that she loved the girl as a daughter, never a cuckoo, did he allow the walls of his own heart to weaken.
He permitted the baby's divine innocence to permeate his tired and wounded spirit, and he embraced the completion of his little family. The strength it gained as its membership grew from 2 to 3. And by, he forgot about the book and the joy its illustrations had given him. He devoted himself to towing the Montrachet family line, ignored Eliza's existence, and, when Adeline asked him to alter John Singer Sargent's portrait thus, bore willingly, if not happily, the dishonor at having tampered with the great man's work. It seemed to Nathaniel that by then he'd crossed so many lines of principle, once presumed inviolable, that one more wouldn't hurt. Nathaniel reached the clearing at the center of the maze, and a pair of peacocks appraised him briefly before continuing on their way. He went carefully to avoid the metal ring that threatened to trip a man up, then entered the narrow strait that began the way towards the hidden garden. Nathaniel froze, branches breaking, light footfalls, heavier than those belonging to the peacocks. He stopped, turned quickly. There, a flash of white. There was someone following him. "Who is it?" His voice was raspier than he'd expected. He forced some steel into it. "I insist that you come out from hiding." A moment's pause, then his pursuer was revealed. "Ivory!" Relief was followed quickly by consternation. "What are you doing here? You know you're not permitted beyond the maze gates."
"Please, Papa," said the little girl, "take me with you. Davy says there's a garden at May's End, where all the world's rainbows begin."
Nathaniel couldn't help but admire the image. "Does he now?" Ivory nodded, with the sort of childlike earnestness that captivated Nathaniel. He consulted his pocket watch. Adeline would be back within the hour, eager to check his progress on Lord Haymarket's commission. There wasn't time to take Ivory home and then return, and who knew when opportunity would present itself again. He scratched his ear and sighed. "Come then, little one." She followed closely, humming a tune that Nathaniel recognized as Oranges and Lemons. Lord knew from whom she'd learned it. Not from Rose, who had a terrible memory for lyrics and melody, nor Adeline, for whom music had little meaning. One of the servants, no doubt. For want of a proper governess, his daughter was passing much of her time with the Blackhurst staff. Who could guess what other questionable skills she was acquiring as a consequence?
"Papa?"
"Yes?"
"I made another picture in my mind."
"Oh?" Nathaniel pushed a thorny bramble aside so that Ivory could pass.
"It was the ship with Captain Ahab on it, and the whale swimming just by."
"What color was the sail?"
"White, of course."
"And the whale?"
"Gray, like a storm cloud."
"And what did your ship smell like?"
"Salty water and Davies' dirty boots."
Amused, Nathaniel raised his eyebrows. "I imagine it did." It was one of their favorite games, played often on the afternoons Ivory had taken to spending in his studio. It had surprised Nathaniel to discover that he so enjoyed the child's company. She made him see things differently, more simply, in a way that brought new life to his portraits. Her frequent questions as to what he was doing and why he was doing it required him to explain things he had long ago forgotten to appreciate. That one must draw what one sees, not what one imagines is there. That every image is comprised merely of lines and shapes. That color should both reveal and conceal.
"Why are we going through the maze, Papa?"
"There is someone on the other side whom I must see." Ivory digested this.
"Is it a person, Papa?"
"Of course it's a person. Do you think your Papa might be meeting with a beast?"
They turned a corner, then another in quick succession, and Nathaniel was put in mind of a marble slipping through the twists and turns of the run Ivory had constructed in the nursery. Following the bends and straights with little control over its own destiny. A silly notion, of course, for what were his actions today if not those of a man taking charge of his own fate? They made a final turn and arrived at the door to the hidden garden. Nathaniel stopped, knelt down, and cupped his daughter's bony shoulders gently in his hands. "Now, Ivory," he said carefully, "I have brought you through the maze today."
"Yes, Papa."
"But you must never come again. And certainly not alone." Nathaniel pressed his lips together. "And I believe it would be best if this trip of ours today..."
"Don't worry, Papa. I won't tell Mama."
Within the pit of Nathaniel's stomach, relief mixed with the uncomfortable sensation of having colluded with his child against his wife.
"Nor Grandmama neither, Papa."
Nathaniel nodded, smiled weakly. "It's best that way."
"A secret?"
"Yes, a secret." Nathaniel pushed open the door to the hidden garden and ushered Ivory through. He had half expected to see Eliza sitting like the queen of the fairies on the tuft of grass beneath the apple tree, but the garden was still and silent. The only movement came from a robin, the same one, who cocked his head and watched, almost proprietorially, as Nathaniel made his way along the zigzag path.
"Oh, Papa,"
said Ivory, staring in wonder at the garden. She gazed upward, taking in the creepers that snaked their way back and forth from the top of one wall to the top of the other.
"It's a magical garden."
How odd that a child should perceive such a thing. Nathaniel wondered what it was about Eliza's garden that made one feel such splendor could not have come naturally. That some bargain had been struck with spirits on the other side of the veil to procure such wild abundance. He guided Ivory through the southern door and down the path that hugged the side of the cottage. Despite the hour, it was cool and dark in the front garden, courtesy of the stone wall that Adeline had had built. Nathaniel laid a hand between Ivory's shoulder blades, her fairy wings. "Now listen," he said. "Papa is going inside, but you must wait here in the garden."
"Yes, Papa."
He hesitated. "Don't go wandering now."
"Oh, no, Papa."
Said so innocently, as if to wander where she shouldn't was the furthest thing from her mind. With a nod, Nathaniel went to the door. He knocked and waited for Eliza to come, straightened the cuff of his sleeve. The door opened, and there she was, as if he'd last seen her yesterday, as if the 4 years hadn't passed between. While Nathaniel sat on a chair by the table, Eliza stood on the other side, fingers resting lightly on its rim. She was looking at him in that singular way she had, empty of the usual social nicety that suggested she was pleased to see him. Was it vanity that had made him think she might be pleased to see him? Something within the cottage light conspired to turn her hair brighter red than usual. Flints of sunlight played within its tangles, made it look as if it really had been spun from fairy's gold. Nathaniel chided himself. He was allowing his knowledge of her stories to permeate his vision of the woman herself. He knew better than that. A strangeness sat between them. There was much to be said, yet nothing he could think to say. It was the first time he'd seen her since the arrangements had been made. He cleared his throat, reached out as if to take her hand. couldn't seem to help himself. She lifted her fingers suddenly and turned her attention to the range. Nathaniel leaned back against his chair. He wondered how to begin, what words to wrap his message in. "You know why I have come," he said finally, without turning. "Of course." He watched her fingers, such narrow fingers, as she put the kettle on the stove. "You know, then, what I have to say." "Yes." From outside, riding lightly on the breeze that swept through the window, came a voice, the sweetest voice. "Oranges and lemons, say the bells of St. Clement's." Eliza's back stiffened so that Nathaniel could see the small knots at her nape, like a child's spine. She turned sharply. "The girl is here?" Nathaniel was perversely pleased by the expression on Eliza's face, that of an animal on the unexpected brink of capture. He longed to put it on paper, the widened eyes, paled cheeks, tightened mouth. Knew he would attempt to do so as soon as he returned to his studio. "You brought the child here?" "She followed me. I didn't realize until it was too late." A sick look left Eliza's face, transmuted into a weak smile. "She has stealth. Some would say mischief." Eliza sat lightly on the chair. "It pleases me to think the girl likes games." "I don't know that her mother is so pleased by Ivory's adventurous streak." Her smile was impossible to read. "And certainly her grandmama is not." The smile broadened. Nathaniel met it briefly, then looked away. He sighed her name, Eliza, and shook his head, started what he had come to say. "The other day, I was glad the other day to see that the child is well." She spoke quickly, anxious, it seemed, to prevent his line of conversation. "Of course she is well. She wants for nothing." "The appearance of plenty can be deceptive. It doesn't always mean a person is well." "Ask your wife." "That's needlessly cruel." A sharp nod. Simple agreement. Not a shred of regret. Nathaniel found himself wondering whether perhaps she had no morality, but he knew that wasn't so. She gazed unblinkingly at him. "You have come about my gift." Nathaniel lowered his voice. "It was foolish of you to bring it. You know how Rose feels." "I do. Only I thought, what harm could the delivery of such an item cause? You know what sort of harm, and I know you, as a friend to Rose, would not wish to cause her anguish." "As a friend to me..." He felt suddenly foolish, looked towards the ground, the floorboards, as if for support. "I must beg you not to come again, Eliza. Rose suffered dreadfully after your visit. She doesn't like to be reminded. Memory is a cruel mistress with whom we all must learn to dance." Before Nathaniel could sculpt a reply,